judges of the United States Court of Appeals in the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention. As this court is now sitting, God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll hear argument first in the case of Peeler against MCI WorldCom.
May it please the court. My name is Ron Wachikowski. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Sally Peeler, who has brought this case on behalf of herself and other landowners who are similarly situated. We are here on the appeal of the denial of a request for injunctive relief, and our position on this appeal is founded on three what I believe are critical points. The first is that WorldCom, the defendant in this case, has never owned the legal right to use the property in question for fiber optic cable purposes. Rather, Ms. Peeler is the sole owner of that property right.
Did you make any showing of that in the district court?
We certainly did, Your Honor. We showed that Ms. Peeler owned the right by presenting evidence of her warranty deed that she received at the time she purchased this property in 1988. We showed that she was continuous in possession of that property through the time of this hearing. We showed as well that in June of 2000, she transferred some of those rights to the City of Carmel, specifically the rights with respect to what has now been called the Monon Trail right-of-way. But she specifically retained in that document, which was a quitclaim deed, she specifically retained in that document all fiber optic cable rights. And I think it's critical that the court note the language that was provided in that quitclaim deed, where she said that she was retaining all rights with respect to fiber optic cable, which is presently installed or in the future may be installed below the surface. She also specified in this quitclaim deed that authorization for additional cables shall take place only with prior written consent of Ms. Peeler. And as you know, in June of last year, WorldCom went on her property to install an additional cable. They never gave consent. Now, they have purported to have some authority along those lines based on two deals that they've made. They made a deal some time ago, or actually a predecessor of WorldCom made a deal with CSX. CSX was the railroad that owned this right-of-way and used it for some period of time and then abandoned it many years ago. The evidence, however, established that in a prior case, Clark versus CSX, it was established that CSX had no ownership of this of the Category A properties that were involved. And Ms. Peeler is one of those Category A properties.
Can I ask you a question? You were talking about the earlier installations as well as this. In light of the Indiana Supreme Court's decision in the Kincaid case, can you explain to me whether WorldCom or any of its predecessors did anything on this property between 1995 and when they attempted to enter, when they did enter and did the work they did in 2000?
I think the record is that from 1995, when they installed the first cable on this right-of-way, and the time
didn't
of the installation.
Did they install all three conduits at that point and just pulled the one cable?
The record is a little unclear as to whether there were two or three conduits installed at that time, but there were additional conduits installed at that time along with splice boxes and the like.
Okay.
But in terms of distinguishing this case from Kincaid, Your Honor, I guess the first distinction that we would draw in terms of what the circumstances are here and in Kincaid is that in this case, we are in fact asserting Article 1, Section 21 of the Indiana Constitution as a provision that has been violated. That was never asserted in the Kincaid case and never addressed by the Kincaid court.
Therefore, Kincaid didn't deal with any of the earlier precedent? It did not deal with any of the earlier precedent?
It dealt with none of the precedent relating to Section 21 of Article 1 of the Constitution of Indiana, Your Honor.
Notwithstanding that, would you argue that the Indiana Supreme Court would regard delay as irrelevant if there in fact was delay here?
No, if the case was such that the principles of equity would say you've sat on your rights, then I think you're right, Your Honor, that would be a case where the Indiana Supreme Court, as indicated by Kincaid, might say injunction is inappropriate. This is not a case where the rights that are being asserted here have been sat upon. The rights that are being asserted here do not deal with what was installed in 1995. The rights that are being asserted here is what WorldCom is doing today and was doing last summer. In fact, it was on June 26th that Ms. Peeler observed WorldCom personnel on her property, completely contrary to what her documents provided.
Is there a splice?
And 2 days later went to court to get relief.
Is there a splice box on her property?
There is.
Or on her, the property she claims to be.
And one of the things that happened last summer was that they had a small splice box on her property. It was about 2 feet by 3 feet. They exchanged that for one of a little over 5 feet by 3 feet.
So is it your view then that they'll have to come on that property from time to time in order to deal with the splice box?
Actually, the evidence is very clear on that, Your Honor. There was testimony by a WorldCom representative that maintenance is something that they have to do routinely in connection with the cable on their property, and that they've done that in the past with respect to the 1995 cable, in response to Your Honor's question, and that they will need to do it in the future. In fact, WorldCom's counsel asked for a stipulation that that kind of maintenance work was going to be required.
Your view of this case is the 95 cable is not in issue. Am I correct at all?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But everything with respect to the latter cable is. In other words, its presence, its future maintenance. So you're talking about present injury is and prospective.
And if WorldCom should decide today they want to install a third cable or a third, fourth conduit, we want an injunction that says they cannot enter our property, Ms. Peeler's property, because she has the right to it. WorldCom does not.
And you premise the right to the injunction on this particular provision of the Indiana Constitution.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in particular, on the case law, and more specifically.
Is it clear that that provision of the Indiana Constitution was meant to cover people like WorldCom? Is that what the framers had in mind?
Well, I think it's clear that it was meant to cover entities that possess the power of condemnation, public utilities. It was not meant to cover the state or municipalities. It specifically is limited to private entities. When 13 years after the Indiana Constitution was adopted and this provision was adopted, the Indiana Supreme Court decided the Seidner case, where it specifically addressed this provision in relation to a turnpike company, which had condemnation power.
I gather this provision was a product of a populist era in Indiana government when corporations exercising quasi-governmental powers were looked upon with, looked upon askance.
Well, we presented in our reply brief, as I'm sure the court has read, a number of quotations from the constitutional history, from people who were the framers of the Constitution and the ratifiers, to the effect that this was an issue of some moment, because there were a number of railroads and turnpike companies and others that were coming upon the property of the individual citizens and just taking it. And then they would go bankrupt and not pay later. And that was an issue of considerable moment. That's why the Constitution was amended in this respect.
But of course there's no, at least, no record that there's any risk of that here, and I wonder if you could address for a moment the public interest aspect of the injunction that you want, because at the end of the day, that is certainly an important part of a court's decision in deciding to grant any injunction, and even if you're right about all of the other aspects of this, isn't it quite disproportionate? WorldCom argues, look, this lady just wants money anyway. Why would you reserve subsurface rights to fiber optic cable as an individual? And here that we would be out, you know, millions of dollars in rerouting and all these things. Why is it in the public interest to have such an injunction?
Well, let me first suggest that as a matter of Indiana law, the public interest of a company like WorldCom and its finances have already been decided by the Indiana Constitution. And let me suggest that every time an entity like WorldCom has the power of to condemn, there has to be a public interest. There has to be a present necessity for it.
In other words, your view is this particular provision of the Indiana Constitution in itself constitutes an important public interest that has to be weighed against any public interest there is in letting WorldCom continue to keep its lines there.
Absolutely. What we're suggesting is that the framers of the Constitution made that decision, that public interest that way.
There was a premise in my colleague's question that I'd like to know whether you accept or not. Is there any question about the fact that WorldCom has the capacity to pay you in the future?
There's nothing in the record on that issue, Your Honor. I mean, I presume the court might take judicial notice of the fact that Dotcoms and other fiber optic cable companies have met with considerable financial distress in recent years. Whether WorldCom will meet that, there's no evidence of that. But what the framers of the Constitution said, we're not getting into that. Before someone like WorldCom takes property, they've got to pay for it first. And that's what they did here. They took her property, the fiber optic cable rights that she retained.
Could you speak to this issue of mootness that is raised in the briefs? Why isn't the stuff's on the land? What, in your view, what's left?
Well, there are two basic responses to the claim of mootness in this case, Your Honor. The first response is that the request for injunctive relief is considerably broader than simply to enjoin the construction activity that was occurring last summer. It was to enjoin any construction of any cable or other equipment in violation of her rights. And that request was made in the complaint in count 6, where we specifically asked for an injunction as to any installation and as to any entry, with certain exceptions that were put in later. So the request for injunction is considerably broader than that construction activity last summer. And to the extent that we're concerned only with that construction activity last summer, and I admit that that is no longer live. That is not live. But that's exactly the kind of issue that's subject to repetition, capable of evading review, unless this matter is reviewed in circumstances like this. I say that my time has elapsed for the opening, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Hendo.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm David Hanzo with Jenner and Block, appearing on behalf of the appellees, MCI WorldCom, Inc., and MCI WorldCom Network Services, Inc. As a matter of practical reality, this is a case about money. And I say that because of the very limited interest that the appellant...
Exactly. That turns out to be my major question. About how much money? If WorldCom were to condemn the property rights, how much would it have to pay under Indiana law?
Your Honor, there has been an appraisal done. It's not in the record, I believe, and quite frankly, I don't recall what the amount is. If I...
Is there any chance it would exceed $75,000?
No, there is not.
Well, then I don't understand why we have federal jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I think federal jurisdiction is premised on the fact that in this case, the appellant has requested an injunction.
He's requested an injunction, but only an injunction as a consequence of your client's failure to pay money. Suppose there are two means for a defendant to satisfy the plaintiff's demand. One is cheap, you know, $10,000, maybe in this case $1,000, and the other is extremely expensive. The defendant could, say, tear down its headquarters building that had encroached 1/2 inch on the plaintiff's land. Your position seems to be that, for purposes of the amount in controversy, the value of the controversy is the expensive means of satisfying the plaintiff's demand rather than the cheap means of satisfying the plaintiff's demand. And I'm not sure why that should be so.
Your Honor, I think the reason that is so is that if the injunction were granted, the cheap means of satisfying the appellant's demand would
be. The injunction wouldn't be granted if WorldCom paid. Right, this is an injunction that is used to enforce an underlying obligation to condemn the land and pay.
That's correct.
Well, suppose a state court just enters a money judgment and it says, we're entering a money judgment for $3, but if it's not paid, the president of WorldCom will go to jail for a year. Now, what's the amount in controversy, $3 or the loss to WorldCom of having its president in jail for a year?
I understand. In that scenario, it's $3, but I would submit that's not the scenario we have here. What the appellant has asked for is an injunction to preclude the completion of construction, and that was the remedy.
Unless
and
until the land is condemned and paid for.
That's right.
Not an unconditional request.
I understand that. And just to play that out, let's say that injunction were granted, and the court says, we are granting this injunction unless and until you complete condemnation. At that point, the record shows that given the amount of time it would take to complete condemnation, WorldCom would experience substantial losses, very much exceeding $75,000, between that time and the time you could complete condemnation.
Is the time for condemnation a function of how quickly people move, or is it a function of statute, or is it a function of some combination?
It is a function of a combination of that.
And how long does the statute then? What sort of delay do you face under the statute?
At the time this was filed, we had a delay, I believe, of at least 30 days because there had to be an offer tendered to the appellant, and she had to have a certain period of time to consider it before we could move forward with the condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a period of time after that they filed objections and asked for a discovery of 60 days. And given the record in this case, just that period of time would have cost WorldCom very, very substantial amounts of money. So the reality is, if the injunction had been granted and the court said, you can't complete construction until you've condemned, one of two things would have happened. We would have either had to wait that period of time until condemnation, in which case we would have lost substantially.
Or you would have had to pay the plaintiff.
That's correct. But under those circumstances, it's reasonable to expect that what the plaintiff would have demanded for payment would have vastly exceeded the condemnation value. Because that's...
Now, that amounts to shooting yourself in the foot. You can't do that because if the plaintiff demands that, then WorldCom will, in fact, wait and pay the $4.95 later.
Well, I understand.
Presumably, parties could agree on some apportionment. No, the problem is this. WorldCom, by not taking any steps ex ante, exposed itself to this kind of demand ex post. But it's not clear why the defendant's, what amounts to the defendant's choice to gamble on the expensive means of satisfying plaintiff's demand, propels the case into federal court.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that if you wind up in a circumstance where you have to negotiate with the plaintiff or suffer the losses of having to wait for condemnation, I agree with the court that what the plaintiff is going to get from that negotiation isn't the full amount of the losses you would experience prior to condemnation. On the other hand, it's clearly a lot more than what you would pay in condemnation. There's every reason to expect that the plaintiff would extract substantially close to the damages that you would suffer waiting for condemnation. And that amount is so far in excess of $75,000 that it can't be said that the jurisdictional amount isn't met here.
How, by the way, are we confident that the amount is in excess of $75,000 even if we wait? There's said to be an awful lot of dark cable in the world. Is this cable being used at the moment? Is it actually transmitting signal?
There is testimony in the record that the existing fiber was used to capacity.
No, that's not the question I'm asking. Is there evidence in the record that the new fiber optic cable is actually transmitting signals?
I don't believe there is evidence in the record one way or the other.
There's no such evidence. It's not clear that an injunction against using it to transmit signals costs your client a penny.
Well, there is evidence in the record as to the amount of revenue that was going to be lost per month waiting for condemnation. And that amount was very, very, very substantial.
But what kind of evidence was it? Was it subscribers that you'd lined up who weren't going to pay you if the cable wasn't there? Or what was the nature of this evidence?
The nature of the evidence was an affidavit which stated the amount per fiber of revenue that we expected to.
But why did you have that expectation?
Because the testimony in the record was that the existing cable was oversubscribed and could no longer carry the traffic that we had. And frankly, even one fiber was going to put us over the amount of controversy, I believe. Certainly all 288 were going to be off the chart. So I think the reality of this case is, in essence, the requested injunction wound up being, if you will, a bargaining chip.
But you know what worries me about your position throughout this? I don't see why any company like WorldCom or an electric utility or anyone else would ever bother to comply with the Indiana Constitution and go through the condemnation process first instead of doing what you've done. Just go in, you know, with an unmarked truck, have your installation there, and then come in and say, it's too late to stop us, now let's just pay.
I think there are two reasons, Your Honor. The first is it's certainly not our position that an injunction can never issue in this kind of case. And in fact,
but how do you ever enforce something that actually deals with timing, which is what that last clause of the Constitution does?
There are two ways. Certainly, there have been times when the courts have granted injunctions in these kinds of cases. It depends to some degree on the timing. The earlier in the construction phase, the more likely the court is to grant the injunction in Indiana. And here, as the court has noted, the construction really, in the first instance, happened in 1995.
But she's not attacking that. And I recall an Indiana case where they actually required a railroad to tear up some ties that it had installed.
There is a case like that, but there are also subsequent cases in which the court has very clearly said one of the factors we look at, certainly not a dispositive one, but one of the factors is the degree to which the construction has been completed. In Kincaid, for example, the court has said we are close to completion of the facilities. The public interest is very much involved here in using these facilities, and for that reason we find that the public interest militates against
If we were trying to predict how an Indiana court would rule in this case, why don't we just look at what the Indiana court actually ruled before the case was removed?
I think the two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, WorldCom wasn't represented at that hearing. What happened was WorldCom received 15 minutes prior notice of the hearing in the state court, and that wasn't sufficient time for our counsel to get to the courthouse. So that was, in effect, an ex parte ruling.
All right. Well, that's a good reason.
Really, the heart of appellant's case here is that there is this constitutional distinction between private entities and the state with respect to condemnation.
Which appears in the Indiana Constitution, and most of the cases you cited involved municipalities who were condemning, so I didn't find them too helpful.
Your Honor, the reason they are helpful, I would submit, is that the Indiana Supreme Court has not drawn the distinction that the appellant draws between private entities and the state, and the reason it hasn't.
Do we know that for a fact?
Yes.
It seems to me they
have. And I would cite the court to two cases, Thomas versus Lauer, which is mentioned in the briefs of both parties, and Commissioners of Hamilton County versus Goodwin, 109 Northeast 2nd, 88, which is not cited in the papers. And in those cases, what the court said was that although the Constitution might permit a distinction between the state and private entities, statutorily, the Indiana legislature has not authorized that distinction. The Indiana legislature has held both the state and private entities to the same standard. Both, under the eminent domain laws, must pay compensation prior to a taking. And because that is the statutory law of the state, the Indiana Supreme Court has said we're not going to treat these entities differently. And for that reason, the cases we've cited that involve the state or its subdivisions are perfectly applicable here. In addition, we did also cite the Kincaid case, which does involve a private entity, and there the court likewise denied an injunction. My time is short. There are two other things I'd like to mention. One goes to the mootness point, and that is, I think it is important to keep in mind here that what the appellant has asked for is an injunction of a rather short duration. It is an injunction only until condemnation is completed. There is no evidence in the record that there is any need for any additional entry on appellant's property during that short time frame.
Is condemnation underway at this point?
Yes, it is.
That's what I thought. But not finished?
Not finished, correct. It is a matter of sheer speculation that during that time frame there would be any further entry on appellant's property. So we submit that this court's earlier conclusion that this case is moot is correct. Second of all, with respect to whether appellant has demonstrated that she could prevail on the merit, in the trial court below she relied on two things. The Clark case in Indiana, which established that CSX didn't own this parcel in fee. But the Clark appellate decision, which we've cited in our papers, makes it absolutely clear that the Clark case was not deciding who does own the right-of-way.
And what was wrong with her warranty deed?
Her warranty deed doesn't describe the property in a way which includes the right-of-way. It only shows that she owns the adjoining property. It doesn't show that she owns the right-of-way itself. She testified that she owns it in very conclusory terms. But the problem with that is that her deed to the city expressly says that she doesn't
know.
Well,
it's just a quitclaim deed. I mean, every quitclaim deed in the world reads that way.
This one actually goes a little beyond standard quitclaim.
Well, but that part of the language that you quoted, have you ever seen a quitclaim deed?
Yes, Your Honor, but I've never seen one that, I've seen one that says we disclaim warranties. I've never seen one that actually then goes beyond that and expressly says, and by the way, we really don't know what we own, which is exactly what this one says. Based on that, I think it was fair for the court to conclude that appellant hadn't proved that she owns it.
I don't understand what any of these deeds has to do with it. All the warranty deed says is that whoever sold her the property will indemnify her if she turns out not to own all of the rights. It doesn't mean that she owns all of the rights. I could give you a warranty deed to the Dirksen building. I'd expose myself to a lot of liability, but I wouldn't convey the Dirksen building to you.
Well, in any event, she didn't even have that. And so we would submit she hasn't proven that she owns the relevant property. She did, in her reply, raise a further argument, and that is, under Indiana law, if she owns the adjacent property, she, once the railroad line is abandoned, title in the railroad line vests in her. The problem with that is the case she cites doesn't stand for precisely that proposition. What it says is there's a presumption that once the railroad line is abandoned, title would vest in the adjacent landowner. But that presumption is rebuttable. And she did not raise that argument in the trial court. WorldCom, therefore, didn't have any opportunity to rebut that finding or that presumption. We would submit that raising it on appeal is too late. So the record as it existed in the trial court supported the trial court's finding that she had not shown a likelihood of success on the merits. But going back to the first point, I think, the Indiana Supreme Court clearly has found in a number of cases that an injunction need not issue even where you have a taking prior to compensation. Those cases are applicable because the Supreme Court hasn't made the distinction that the appellant wants to draw here. The facts of this case are stronger than the Indiana Supreme Court cases precisely because the appellant does own that very, very limited interest. And I would submit that there is jurisdiction here because of the damages that would incur to WorldCom were an injunction to issue. At a minimum, she would have us over a barrel, and the amount that we would have to pay would be substantial. Beyond that, and I should have
thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Wojciechowski?
Mr. Hanzo ended with a comment that the Indiana Supreme Court has not drawn the distinction between the public and the private entity with respect to whether an injunction is or is not important. In the Seidner case, and we cite the language in the brief, the Indiana Supreme Court specifically asked the question, shall it be prevented, referring to shall the court prevent a private entity like WorldCom intervene to stop what WorldCom has done? And in that case, the appellees insisted that it shall not be prevented, but that the plaintiff shall be left to their action of trespass, or to state the proposition in terms exactly equivalent, that the property may be taken first and the compensation ascertained and paid or tendered afterward, and damages also obtained. It need scarcely be observed that the Constitution is otherwise, and we know of no mode of enforcing obedience to it but by injunction. And then it continues, cases decided where compensation was not required to precede the taking cannot be authority upon this question. The Indiana Supreme Court has made unequivocally clear that in circumstances like this, where a WorldCom takes the property of an Indiana landowner, the landowner is entitled to an injunction. The state court granted that TRO pursuant to that law. We respectfully submit, for the reasons that I've said before and that I will articulate in more detail in a brief, that Ms. Peeler is entitled to an injunction now. And if it is a short period, and we have no reason to believe that it's a short period, we're entitled to an injunction to keep WorldCom from exerting control or dominion or entering that property for that time period. There's no assurance as to whether they
are. Are you seeking an order that the cable that's already been installed be torn out?
No, we are not, Your Honor. We are only seeking an order that WorldCom, its personnel, be kept out with respect to installing any future equipment.
Then that leads me to Mr. Hanzo's question. What reason have we to believe that WorldCom will need access between now and when the condemnation proceeding is completed?
I guess the reverse of that is they've got no right to be there.
No.
And
mootness is a jurisdictional question. we need some reason to suppose that a decision rendered here will be other than advisory.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's the question I'm asking. What reason have we to believe that WorldCom will need access between now and the conclusion of the condemnation?
From the record, Your Honor, they indicated that they would need access in order to maintain the fiber optic cable. As to the record, the issue of the condemnation wasn't even filed until sometime after that proceeding. We don't know when or if that condemnation proceeding will be successful. We do know that WorldCom is continuing to assert dominion and control over Ms. Buehler's property and has no right to do so.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of IDX Systems against Epic Systems.